Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Last spring, as Americans scrambled to disinfect surroundings and de-germ hands, the production of Clorox wipes could not keep up with demand. In the face of a still-evolving virus, distilleries throughout the country shifted from manufacturing beer and spirits to hand sanitizer. Stores like Target and Walmart were limiting purchases of the stuff to prevent hoarding. What are the effects on people and the environment from months of strict hand hygiene and increased use of disinfecting chemicals? Dr. Amy Sapkota thinks a lot about these questions and joins us to talk about them. She's a professor of applied environmental health in the University of Maryland School of Public Health. Her research looks at the relationships between environmental microbial exposures and human infectious diseases, with a special focus on assessing the public health impacts associated with reusing water. She's the director of Conserve, a multi-institution center that looks at ways to promote sustainable water reuse in agriculture. Welcome to On the Record, Professor Sapkota.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
We're going to ask you more about conserve and water reuse in a few minutes, but let's start with some basics about microbes. Talk about the difference between good bacteria and bad bacteria for humans.
So if we look at the big picture, we are surrounded with microorganisms. We live in a world of microorganisms. They are everywhere we can imagine. And they're everywhere on our bodies and in our bodies. And the great majority of them, and I'm talking about bacteria, are beneficial. So 99.99% of them, for example, are good for us and really help us maintain good health. So it's only a very small fraction of bacteria, for example, that are pathogens that can cause disease.
Well, I mean, for the last year, a lot of us are probably using hand sanitizer several times a day. When we talk about overuse or inappropriate use of antibacterials and antimicrobials, what are we talking about?
So there's a growing concern, and this has been happening for many decades, that when we have inappropriate use of antimicrobial agents, so these can be the antibiotics that we take internally for infections. These can also be the antimicrobials that are used in different pharmaceuticals and personal care products, or antimicrobials that are used in surfaces. So whenever we use them too much, the use of these antimicrobials can help select for antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And so then you might ask, well, what are antibiotic-resistant bacteria? So if someone is colonized and then ultimately infected with an antibiotic-resistant bacteria that is a human pathogen, if they go to seek treatment from a physician, for example, and take an antibiotic, this antibiotic might not be effective against those organisms.
Well, but back up for me. Why does using antimicrobials result in resistant bacteria?
As I mentioned, there's a lot of different antimicrobials, disinfectants out there. When we're first talking about, you mentioned hand sanitizers. So those can contain ethanol, for example, isopropanol. And these are agents that are not typically viewed as antimicrobial disinfectants. But if we're talking about other compounds like triclosan, triclocarban, that can be in a lot of our personal care products, We know that they can be similar in their impacts against bacteria, and at the molecular level, because of their mechanisms of action, when bacteria become resistant to those antimicrobials, they can also carry the genes that are resistant to human use antibiotics.
Is it just random that some bacteria will grow resistant when they're faced with antibacterials?
Sure. Well, so if we step back, any and all use of antibiotics, even appropriate use, will ultimately select for antibiotic-resistant bacteria, because this is just how bacterial evolution works. But we want to kind of slow that evolution so that we can use our antibiotics as long as we can when we need them against these harmful pathogens.
I want to bring it to what we're living through now. This past year, obviously, we've seen a spike in use of antibacterials. Have you seen or heard any indications of the impacts of overuse?
So I think what we've seen is we've seen an increased use of disinfectants. So this is, so it's very different. Disinfectants are antimicrobial, but it's very different from something when we're talking about antibiotics that are used to treat bacterial infections. So we have seen a lot of use of disinfectants, particularly as disinfectants that might be used on surfaces. And there are a range of different types of disinfectants that are out there. Some are, more safe to use than others. For example, disinfectants that are based, that are largely comprised of ethanol or isopropanol are safer use products versus those that may contain quaternary ammoniums may not be as safe for human health. So we know that excessive use of quaternary ammonium compounds in disinfectants can cause irritations, can cause respiratory symptoms if there's a lot of exposure to these compounds.
So alcohol is a safer bet when you're looking at the ingredients.
Yes. And so so if you think of maybe the most widely used hand sanitizer, particularly prior to the pandemic, you think of Purell, and that's an ethanol-based product.
Alcohol. Another thing about this year, children have spent a lot more time indoors. What could be the ramifications of that change in behavior?
So, the first thing that comes to mind is really the children being so sedentary. So they're spending a lot of time sitting, whereas maybe prior to the pandemic, they would spend a lot more time running outside, interacting with the natural environment, interacting with dirt, for example, playing out in their yards, playing on playgrounds. So first of all, in terms of being sedentary, we know this is a significant public health issue where we've seen a lot of weight gain among our youth. And then getting back to sort of exposure to beneficial organisms, with kids being inside, they're not interacting as much with dirt and the outdoor environment. And so they're likely to be have less exposure to potentially good beneficial bacteria that are out there in our soil, for example.
It's University of Maryland Applied Environmental Health Professor Amy Sepkota. On the Record on WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about good and bad bacteria and how the overuse of antibacterial products can be dangerous. What are your thoughts about what supporters call deep cleaning practices and critics call theater of hygiene, the widespread spraying of antibacterial chemicals in subways and on buses and other places?
Early on in the pandemic, we weren't really sure what the major transmission routes were, or we were really beginning to get a better understanding of the major transmission routes for SARS-CoV-2, which is the causative agent of COVID-19. So we knew that transmission in droplets and airborne transmission was important, but we weren't sure about the role of surfaces in transmitting the virus. And so that's why we saw widespread use of disinfectants in public spaces. If we fast forward to a year later, we have a lot more data, and we know that the primary transmission route is, sort of the hot spot of transmission is in an indoor environment when you have a lot of people crowding indoors where folks are not wearing masks, and you have that spread through droplets or airborne transmission. So we know now that surfaces really don't play a really big role at all in the transmission of this virus. But it's still very important. Hand washing is still one of the most important things you can do to prevent the spread of many different illnesses. So continued hand washing with just soap and water is really essential as we continue to combat this virus.
Tease that out a little bit for me. It's a little hard to understand why I should be less worried than I was told to be a year ago about the surfaces I touch, but I still need to wash my hands fervently. Why?
So for instance, we do a lot with our hands. So we eat with our hands. You might see particularly children picking their noses with their hands. So we want to make sure that regardless what we may have touched out there in public, that we are effectively cleaning our hands and not having that sort of hand-to-face interaction. I'm not sure if that gets at your question or not.
Well, not really. I mean, it's if one of the arguments for washing our hands is that we might have touched something and would then, with our fingers, carry a bad substance like the coronavirus close to our nose or eyes, then that seems to say those surfaces are still dangerous and we should busily disinfect them as we have been doing.
I don't want to sort of, misconstrue words here. So we know that surfaces are not the major route of exposure. It's possible that you could still have a surface that may have a level of the virus that could be infectious. We still are learning a lot about this virus. So this is why you still want to take precautions. But I think what I'm trying to get across here, though, is the most important things that we can do moving forward to try to control the pandemic are to continue to wear masks, to continue to not be in crowded indoor spaces where you have more of that potential for exposure to contaminated droplets or potential airborne spread. That is the most important thing we can do to protect ourselves and our family. But continued hand washing, of course, is part of the picture, though, again, because even though I'm saying that surfaces probably play a limited role, there still could be the potential for transmission. We're still learning about this virus.
Hand washing we do with soap and water. And walk us through how that's different than what we accomplish with a disinfectant or a sanitizer.
Sure. And let me just sort of make it clear. Good old-fashioned soap and water is all you need to effectively clean your hands. So it's great to use a hand sanitizer if you don't have access to that warm, soapy water. You know, if you're out and about and you can't wash your hands, it is another option. But the best option is just to wash your hands per the guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And their guidelines for hand washing are guidelines that often aren't followed. So you'll see a lot of people quickly wash their hands with maybe even just water and not use soap. But what folks should be doing is washing their hands with warm soapy water, every surface of the hand, the palms, the outside of the hands, under the fingernails. And, you know, one of the guidelines is that you should be able to sing the happy birthday song twice while you're washing your hands, and that will effectively clean your hands. So that's still the best practice. But again, if you don't have immediate access to water and soap, a hand sanitizer is a great alternative.
Amy Sepkota is a professor of applied environmental health in the University of Maryland School of Public Health. We've been talking about the increased use of antibacterial products and the possible effects of that. When we're back from a short break, we'll ask about her research on sustainable water reuse and how our cleaning products can affect that. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Our guest today is Dr. Amy Sepkota. She's a professor of applied environmental health at the University of Maryland School of Public Health. We've been talking about the increased use of antibacterial agents in response to the coronavirus and its effect on health. Now we're going to turn to another focus of her research. Her work as director of CONSERVE, a center of excellence at the nexus of sustainable water reuse, food, and health. CONSERVE is a multi-institution center that looks at ways to promote sustainable water reuse in agriculture. It's funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the National Institute of Food and Agriculture. Professor Sepkota, tell us more about the mission of CONSERVE.
Sure. So let's take a look at the big picture first. So if we look globally, in many different areas of the world, we are running out of fresh water. And this is due to a number of different factors. Climate change is one large factor, population growth, increased urbanization, to name a few. And so if we want to address what we will see as future water shortages, we have to look and see, well, what are the biggest users of water globally? And we know that globally, if we look at all of our freshwater use, 70% of our freshwater withdrawals are going towards agricultural irrigation. So if we want to address water security issues, we have to address how we use water in the agricultural environment. So one potential solution that can enable us to conserve water in agriculture, particularly if we're talking about precious groundwater resources, is to reuse other types of water that might be more readily available to us. And these water sources fall under sort of a general umbrella term of recycled water or non-traditional irrigation water.
And non-traditional water is what?
So there's a lot of different types of non-traditional water. One large type is advanced treated municipal wastewater. So this is the water that originates in our toilets, our showers, industries, hospitals, and ends up going down to our wastewater treatment plants and is treated to a very high level. It's not treated to a level that is safe to drink, but it is treated to a high enough water quality level that we can use this water or reuse the water for beneficial purposes like food crop irrigation.
Standards for drinking water and standards for water used in agriculture are different?
Yes, they're very different.
How does our use of antibacterial or antimicrobial products like Lysol or hand sanitizer affect the water we use?
So anything that we use in our homes, any type of cleaning products or antimicrobials, any drugs that we actually ingest that actually end up excreted in our urine or our feces, for example, any of those particular products are ending up in our waste stream and going down to the wastewater treatment plant. But at the wastewater treatment plant, these plants were not designed to remove organic chemicals like pharmaceuticals and personal care products or antimicrobials. These plants were designed to reduce what we call biological oxygen demand of the water, or BOD, so that the water could safely be discharged to surface waters without killing aquatic life. So because the plants weren't designed to remove these types of compounds, when we start with this advanced treated wastewater that's coming out of the wastewater treatment plants, you still can have different pharmaceuticals and personal care products like antimicrobial compounds still in that water. But we would then like to use that water, as I mentioned, for other purposes like food crop irrigation. But we have to be aware of the fact that those compounds could still be present in the water and maybe may need to be cleaned up an additional way before we can safely use it on a food crop.
And is there a way to do that short of treating it the way we do to make it clean enough to be drinking water?
There are so many different engineering technologies at our disposal that we can use to clean up the water. It wouldn't necessarily be cleaned up to a potable drinking water standard, but it would be cleaned up to a level that would be more suitable for food crop production and would meet our federal standards for those types of water.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with University of Maryland Applied Environmental Health Professor Amy Sapkota. We're talking about her work as director of CONSERVE, a center of excellence at the nexus of sustainable water reuse, food, and health. So what do you actually do to carry out the mission of CONSERVE? Do you work directly with farmers?
So CONSERVE is a very large center. Here in the United States, it includes 9 different institutions, including different academic institutions, USDA. We are funded by the USDA National Institute of Food and Agriculture to begin with. And we also have partners in Southern Israel at the Erava Institute. And so we have a large team of faculty, students, staff, and we work on research, education, and extension. And so through our research, we are identifying the availability of non-traditional irrigation water and is it proximal to working farms here in the US? We look at the water quality. We develop cost-effective on-farm water treatment solutions that can treat the water to a suitable level for food crop irrigation. But then we have also have a team of researchers that's looking at the societal context of water reuse. So what are our laws, or what are our regulations that dictate how, when, and where we can use this water? What is the consumer response to water reuse for food production? So then we take that research and we engage with multiple stakeholders, including farmers, as well as non-agricultural communities. And then we also have a very large experiential education component because we want to be training our next generation of future leaders who are engaged in successful water reuse.
You're working with farmers both here and in some other countries. Are you finding that the societal demands are different?
So that's a great question. And the demands really depend on where you sit on the planet. So if you're living in an area where you've had decades of water insecurity, farmers are much more excited about and much more willing and interested in finding water reuse solutions that can suit their needs. And I'll just give the example of some of our farmers working in the Southwest, in California and Arizona, our partner farmers in Israel and the West Bank, for example, and other very water insecure regions of the world. But even here in Maryland, where you think of this as being a water-rich state, that's not necessarily the case in all parts of the state. So we are working with farmers, for example, on our Maryland Eastern Shore. And even though they are proximately located between the Chesapeake Bay and the Atlantic Ocean, they're on land where they just don't have any groundwater. And so they need to be tapping into alternative water sources as well.
As I understand it, Conservice is about 5 years old. Have you moved the needle at all on that 70% number you gave us of how much clean new water is being pulled out for irrigation?
So we are, you know, our mission is to facilitate this safe water reuse in agriculture. And I think we have begun to move the needle. In particular, we are, helping farmers figure out how they can better take advantage of recycled water in their areas. We have our team from the University of Maryland Law School, who has also played an influential role in helping us understand how we can move regulations forward to better suit water reuse needs. And here in the state of Maryland, we've also been working with our Maryland Department of the Environment on updating water reuse regulations. For example, prior to this year, it was not legal to use recycled water on food crops in the state of Maryland. And that's changing now with the updating of existing rules that are coming out of the Maryland Department of the Environment.
Professor Sapkowska, good luck with this.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for telling us about it. Amy Sapkowska directs Conserve, a center of excellence at the nexus of sustainable water reuse, food, and health. She's a professor of applied environmental health in the University of Maryland School of Public Health. We've been talking about her research in sustainable water reuse for agriculture. We've got more information about Conserve at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you're with us on the record. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.